Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
We are now waiting for the verdict of Iran's Court for International Affairs. We will follow up the case in countries that maintain judicial cooperation with Iran. There, we will demand that U.S. assets be blocked and transferred as compensation to the families of the victims. This is to remind the criminal governments that their crimes will not go unanswered.
Israel has a history of targeted killing of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the assassinations, its footsteps can be traced in all of the incidents. In this video, recorded in 2018, ex-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Less than 2 years after this comment, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was a key Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated. Over the years, different American and Israeli officials have spoken openly about, quote, taking down the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry. The plaintiffs here say the U.S. was trying to do so by killing Iranian nuclear scientists, and today by enforcing the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. But they say both measures have so far failed, and the West is now urging Iran to sit and talk about its nuclear program in Vienna to revive the 2015 nuclear pact.
Plaintiffs here hope that their lawsuit against the U.S. will break the chain of Washington's targeting of the Iranian scientific community. But they say the underlying messages are even more important, as the case lays bare the U.S.'s double standards with regards to human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In many cities in France, anti-health pass protesters marched again in what has become a weekly protest. They do not agree with the mandatory measures the French government has established to obtain much more vaccinations. But the protest movement is weakening a bit. Important figures of the Yellow Vests want to re-engage with the original inquiries of the movement, more social justice and against the authoritarian policy of the government. They want to elaborate a political force that will be able to influence the 2022 presidential elections.
Today we are with the angry citizens against the health pass, but as the Yellow Vest movement, we continue demanding more social justice and less taxes and a participative democracy.
70% of the French have received 2 jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. Due to the health pass that people have to show in almost every public places, the virus is soon to be under control and life in France is slowly returning back to normal. The National Institute on Economic Studies, INSEE, announced that the French gross domestic product, GDP, will increase with more than 6% in 2021, after a fall last year of 10%. This is good news for the economy, except that workers' rights are deeply affected by the COVID crisis. More and more people lose their full-time contract, which is often transformed in variable working hours and a temporary contract, less paid and most of all, offering less job security.
I am a volunteer worker. I see the misery. We distribute food. There is much more misery now and more young people are in need.
During the lockdown, people with precarious contracts were affected the most. Today, the government of Macron is reforming the unemployment status. He makes the labor market very flexible. He takes advantage of this crisis to implement his antisocial policy.
French President Macron had once declared that an unemployed person just has to cross the street to find a job. For many people, this is only wishful thinking. The vaccination campaign is certainly successful in pushing back the COVID virus and putting the economy back on track. But the French population remains deeply divided about the mandatory health pass. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khamenei's televised speech addressing the new wave of coronavirus, August 13, 2021. As experts say, if people observe all the protocols, the disease will be mitigated. This way, the health personnel of the country will rest a little and organizations will be able to carry out the task in the best way possible. Then the vaccine will be accessible to everyone. By God's favor, the vaccine will be available in large numbers in a few months if officials show firm determination, which will be the case, God willing. In such circumstances, the risks will reduce. Infections might continue to occur, but there will be no crisis, no high death rates, and no mourning on the part of families. If the people completely stick to the protocols for a few more months, 1, 2, 3, the problem will lessen. Another important matter is about mourning sessions for Imam Hussein and Ashura. These ceremonies are a source of blessing and divine mercy. They help draw the divine attention to the country and the nation. We need these ceremonies and they should exist, but they should be held while health protocols are completely and precisely observed. The officials who organize these ceremonies, the speakers, the preachers, the panegyrists who manage the occasion, and the masses of the people who participate in these ceremonies should abide by the protocols and observe social distancing. They should not allow these ceremonies to, God forbid, turn into an instrument for spreading the disease, which will give the opponents and the enemies the pretext to sarcastically accuse the mourning sessions and ceremonies for Imam Hussein of spreading the disease. You should not let this happen. These protocols should be completely respected in the Muharram occasions. This is one point. The next point is about the people's charitable donations. Some people really need help. The public movement of pious help was carried out in the best way possible in some periods of the past 18 months, in particular during the outbreak of the disease for the first time. At that time, donors and volunteers really entered the arena and helped either with their bodies or with their financial cooperation. They offered all kinds of help to the people who needed it. But this should continue. The movement should surge up again. There are people who have to close down their business, whether there is a lockdown or not. Well, these people face certain problems. In my opinion, mosques should play a key role here. Mosques could be turned into centers of charity and pious help. In every mosque, those people who have financial problems, but whose dignity does not allow them to ask for help, should be identified, and the people can cooperate in this regard. These were my words of advice.
In the limelight.
In Nigeria, the revered Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, following his recent release after an illegally prolonged detention of over 5 years, is again active on the social scene. He has restarted his lectures that over the past decades have changed the face of the northern parts of Africa's most populous country by guiding at least 14 million people to the enlightened path of the Ahlul Bayt, or the blessed household of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff. This article is published under the heading, Sheikh Zakzaki's Spirit of Resistance Back on Nigerian Social Scene. Stay tuned for more. Freedom, its flag bearers, and the resolve to cater to the needs of the society can never be suppressed in any part of the world, despite the most inhuman measures used against them by the traffickers of terrorism. This is the lesson humanity has learned from the epic sacrifice of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, whose martyrdom has continued to inspire the seekers of freedom and justice in every era and in every place. In our own times, there are many vivid examples of how Karbala has infused the spirit of freedom and resistance and the quest for justice in contemporary communities, the prime example being the Islamic Republic of Iran, which for the past 42 years has continued to defeat whatever satanic plots the United States and its agents have come up with. The message from Iran today is evident all around, from Afghanistan to the Levant, and to Latin America and West Africa, where American-sponsored terrorism has failed. In Nigeria, the revered Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, following his recent release after an illegally prolonged detention of over 5 years, is again active on the social scene. He has restarted his lectures that over the past decades have changed the face of the northern parts of Africa's most populous country by guiding at least 14 million people to the enlightened path of the Ahlul Bayt, or the blessed household of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. This had horrified the regime of Muhammadu Buhari, a former general with a bloody record of military coup and seizure of power in 1980s, and who now, despite being an elected president, does not hesitate in taking orders from the world's most notorious terrorist regimes, such as the Zionists and the Wahhabis, to suppress freedom and justice in Nigeria. Sheikh Zakzaki, his most prominent victim, whose sons were killed by the Nigerian military during its terrorist attack on the town of Zaria and the massacre of over 1,000 men, women, and children on 15th December 2015 during a peaceful religious gathering, is possessed with an indomitable spirit that never broke down during the 5.5 years of torturous imprisonment he and his wife went through, even deprived of medical treatment for their ailments. Last Sunday on September 19th, in Abuja, several families of martyrs of the military's December 2015 massacre met with the leader of the Islamic movement, IMN, who consoled them for the losses of their loved ones and urge them to always remember the persecution and hardships suffered by Imam Hussein, peace upon him, at the hands of the army of the Umayyad tyrant Yazid that besieged and massacred them in Karbala in 61 AH. He told the bereaved families that no sacrifice is too high when it comes to the path of Allah, adding, "We are proud of carrying bullet fragments in our bodies, and this is proof of our spirit of resistance and refusal to yield to tyranny." Among the visitors was Dr. Isa Waziri Guantu, who said he lost four of his children during the Zaria massacre, but is determined to follow the right path championed by Sheikh Zakzaki. Another visitor was Hajia Jumei Karofi, who lost five children. The proud mother said, "I would like the killers of my children to know that what they did to them would never scare us away from Sheikh Zakzaki and the Islamic movement in Nigeria. In fact, they are ready to pay the ultimate sacrifice in defense of Islam." It is still not too late for President Buhari to atone for his atrocities against the Nigerian Muslims by apologizing to Sheikh Zakzaki and the bereaved families whose members his army had brutally massacred. Islam is a religion of repentance and forgiveness, and the sooner he does, the better for him in order to weed out repression and injustice from Nigeria. No matter what the Israelis, the Saudis, the Americans, and all other traffickers of terrorism think.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Some 12,000 migrants, mostly from Haiti, have been staying at a camp under a bridge in Del Rio, Texas. Department of Homeland Security saying that 6,500 migrants were taken to custody in advance of processing and removal from the U.S., and on Sunday, flights started to carry Haitian asylum seekers back home. The United Nations has voiced concerns at a U.S. deportation of mostly Haitian refugees. American rights groups have also demanded a halt to the deportations. Expulsions are taking place under a health order, citing the coronavirus pandemic. Now, to begin with this, let's go to Washington, D.C. Our correspondent, Colin Campbell's there. Colin, tell us more about this migration thing and the problems.
Yes, the crisis at the border is very troubling because of the policies that the U.S. has enacted on Haitian immigrants who have walked through Brazil, through South America to get to the border. Can you imagine walking through Brazil and then walking to the border, just some of the atrocities that you face along the way? Well, thousands of Haitian immigrants have gone through this journey in hopes of a better life in America. And this is the welcome that they received. Border Patrol agents on horseback using whips to control them. Children starving, people starving, children crying, getting out of the way of these Border Patrol agents. The imagery is very shocking as we see these people who are already in a very destitute state being welcomed by America, so to speak, in a way that would make them seem like enemies of the country, make them seem like they are invaders to the country. And right now, the Biden administration is being harangued by many who are saying, listen, you need to retool U.S. immigration policy right now because the way you're treating these Haitians is ineffable. And right now, the Biden administration has been deporting thousands of immigrants back to Haiti. When they return, they're worse or no better off than they were when reaching the United States.
This is the Spotlight. You're watching Spotlight with me, your host, Barry. And as you see, we're discussing the migrant problem in the United States. Let me see who's joining me in this episode of the Spotlight. Okay, we have a professor with the City University of New York, Danny Shaw, who's joining us from New York. And later I'll be joined by author and political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation, Keaton Mansfield, also in New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Danny, as you know, U.S. authorities are taking advantage of this pandemic-related health rule called Title 42 health rule, and that was made under former President Donald Trump to expel many of the migrants without offering them, you know, the chance to seek asylum. Is this what Joe Biden had promised to do while he was running in the race for the White House?
Well, I think even beyond the bipartisan issues, whether Biden increases the number of Haitian immigrants and migrants in general who are allowed to come here or doesn't, we have to get in front of this narrative and underneath this narrative that people are just coming here because the United States is so great. What exists here is the relationship between a neo-colonizer and a neo-colony. Many of these Haitians were forced out of Haiti after the 2010 earthquake. They were living in Chile. They were living in Brazil. That situation was no longer tenable. So they continued to travel north, trying to make it to the U.S. and to be met here with insults, racism, humiliation, and even whips from the Border Patrol. The symbolism is huge in terms of how the U.S. ruling class and the U.S. population sees Haiti and Haiti's people. So I think this is an important educational moment so people understand the true relationship that exists between the most powerful imperialist country in the history of humanity and Haiti, which continues to be a neo-colony in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm.
Danny, maybe you've seen those pictures of U.S. border guards using, you know, horse reins to control immigrants. Some observers say that those pictures remind them of the violence seen during the slavery times in the U.S. How do you feel when you see such scenes? Is this how the land of opportunity deals with asylum seekers?
Yeah, the land of opportunity, in big quotation marks, that's part of this mythology that capitalism and white supremacy tries to spread around the world. Those images of the whips and the patronizing tone of the racist white supremacist tone of those Border Patrol guards also harkens back to the 1915 and 1934 U.S. military occupation of Haiti, when thousands of Marines stepped on Haitian dignity and Haitian sovereignty and tracked down the CACOs, the Haitian resistance fighters. The same thing that's happened today in the neocon, whether it was under the auspices of the now assassinated Jovenel Moise, or under Ariel Henry, the prime minister today, the PHTK, the party in power, continues to repress the Haitian popular movement. So Haitians are asking across the country and across the diaspora, when will we be afforded a chance to survive in our own homeland?
Okay. Now, author and public analyst for the Center for Public Innovation, Keithan Mansfield, is also joining us from New York. Good to have with us, Keithan. So the question I have for you is, there are some people who are blaming the policies of President Biden's for this influx of migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. What factors play a role here?
Well, with the advanced people, you have to look back what's happened. It's very telling.
Sorry, I got to jump in. Keithan, we don't hear you, right? So let me just go back to Danny and give our technicians a little bit of time to see if they can fix this problem. Daniel, let our viewers hear your opinion on how President Trump's policies could be responsible for this influx of migrants.
And I would go way before President Trump or President Bush or Tweedledee or Tweedledum, two sides of the same coin. This is decades and centuries of unfettered colonialism and neocolonialism practiced on what many have called the U.S.'s backyard, the Caribbean, Central America, the entire hemisphere. The Haitian people want a new way forward. The Haitian leadership has communicated from Port-au-Prince and Au Cap Haïtien their enthusiasm in seeing the message of Evo Morales going to Cuba and then to Venezuela and CELAC and Nicolas Maduro regrouping in Mexico City. The pivot of Lopez Obrador and the Mexican leadership denouncing the blockade of Cuba. And this is what the Haitian people want. The Haitian people want integration with their peers, south-to-south development, not development based on the underdevelopment of Haiti. That's how they frame it, the development of underdevelopment. Haiti has incredible potential. It always has. It's been always punished because of its great resources under the subsoil, and of course its number one resource, the Haitian people. So the Haitian people are looking for a way forward based on the unity of oppressed people and the integration that Nicaragua, Cuba, Venezuela, and now Bolivia and Peru have spearheaded.
Mm-hmm. Danny, there also writes groups criticizing the Biden administration. They say that the returns are inhumane, and that's because of the dire security and economic situation in countries like Haiti. Let's have your take on that.
Of course, they're 100% correct. And to hear Alejandro Mayorkas talk about how humane their treatment of Haitians was is ridiculous. It's an entire system predicated on treating other human beings as subhuman. But I think we have to go even deeper than these liberal critiques. And as I was saying, even if the U.S. were to Biden were to increase the number, the cap to 200,000 new migrants allowed in. Really, there's 10.5 million Haitians, and if you were to open up the border tomorrow because of these institutional, structural, historical, geopolitical issues, what Haitians would stay home in their homeland? And that same question goes for Dominicans and Mexicans and Salvadorians. When you're talking about so many years of inequality, of exploitation, of the devaluation of a people's currency, of occupation, of sanctions, of invasion. What choice do people have but to flee in pursuit of the stolen resources, the stolen gold, the stolen coffee, the stolen emeralds? So I think this shift in Latin America that's going to play out as we speak at the General Assembly about 100 blocks from me right now, it's going to be very important to see what happens in the next few days. I mean, Latin America and the Caribbean are again on the rise.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have Keaton Mansfield back on the phone for us. Keaton, go ahead with your comments. Sorry for that interruption.
Yes, well, that's very true. As I was at the United Nations building earlier today, only an hour ago, you see many different groups coming together in support of fighting back against U.S. imperialism, fighting for the sovereignty of their homeland, for the rights of their own people, against those in power in the U.S. And so Biden is not living up to what he promised to be on the campaign trail, which seems to be a popular tradition for American politicians to make promises that not only do they not follow through with, but in Biden's case, done the exact opposite, ramping up deportation, ramping up police funding, ramping up foreign intervention. More than anything, it's scary to see that this is the state of the U.S. political climate and the politicians that are put in place to try to represent or pretend to represent the American people. It's a shame. It's a sham.
Keaton, rights groups argue that Title 42 is not based on science and is actually a violation of U.S.'s own immigration laws, and they're asking the president to reverse that policy. Now, would President Biden take heed of that and reverse the policy?
I find it unlikely. You know, the U.S. constantly violates its own procedures, protocols. It violates U.N. procedures and international protocols. So the idea that Biden would, unless he's faced with perhaps severe retribution or severe criticism from his own internal party bureaucracy, from Democrats who are in power already, who have sold out to the system, sold out to imperialist practices, it would be very unlikely that Biden would do a 180, so to speak, and suddenly become the president that he pretended he was on the campaign trail.
Okay. Now, Danny, we had White House spokesman just recently announcing that the U.S. government has a range of program options and financial support in place that would assist Haitian nationals and authorities without specifying any further. What could those plans be?
Well, at the most, there'll be drops in the ocean, drops in the bucket. These are liberal band-aids that won't change anything fundamentally in Haiti. It's the core group. It's the Organization of American States and the UN acting under the auspices of the U.S. Embassy that have the final say in all things Haitian. This is an issue about Haitian self-determination. Colonialism and the neocolonialism has always been a one-armed bandit extracting from Haiti. So for Jen Psaki or any representative of the Biden government or any U.S. government to try to project this benevolence towards Haiti is extremely hypocritical. The true benevolence would come in the form of reparations to the tune of billions and billions of dollars restored to the Haitian people for the historical wrongs that have been visited upon them by successive U.S. administrations, both Democrat and Republican.
Mm-hmm. Now, Keaton, we also have the UN Human Rights Office expressing disappointment that there have apparently not been any individual assessments of the cases of the migrants by the United States. Why shouldn't that happen?
Well, the U.S. has been guilty of human rights violations since the American War for Independence in 1776, be it persecution and military removal and extinction of Native American tribes here in the U.S., or during World War II, the imprisonment of Japanese Americans, or of course, Jim Crow era and slavery. The U.S. has a long-standing history. The United States government has a long-standing history of human rights abuses. And then the U.S. will take this, however, and then make international claims that, no, China is the enemy. China is abusing human rights. Iran is abusing human rights. Cuba, Venezuela, Haiti, the list goes on and on. At this point, it seems that human rights, or the concept of human rights, has simply become a political bargaining tool to those in power, to the most powerful in the UN, to Britain and the United States. So to toy with this idea that the U.S. will rightfully and thoroughly address human rights allegations, to me seems like nonsense. It would be very out of character for the U.S. state apparatus.
Danny, let's look at it from a different angle. Isn't it thanks to Washington's own policies and meddling in some countries' affairs that forces some people to leave their countries and look for better lives elsewhere, like in the U.S.? I mean, isn't it the case of chickens coming home to roost?
That's exactly correct, and not just some people, but millions and millions, if not billions. How many Libyans, how many Syrians, how many Afghans have died making the perilous trek across the Mediterranean, across Asia and Europe, trying to find a better way? So people are going to follow capital. People historically are going to follow the very resources usurped from them. It really comes at no surprise. And this is going to continue to happen. The right-wing media blitz right now, they continue to call this Biden's border crisis, as though Biden somehow created all of this. This goes way deeper than any individual politician. This goes hemisphere and centuries deep. So it begs a much more critical perspective on U.S. foreign policy. And until there's a fundamental change in the relationship between U.S. hegemony and U.S. unipolarity in the world's people, nothing will change. And how hypocritical Biden was at the U.N. just a few hours ago talking about there's no new Cold War, will work with anybody. But look at the unfettered aggression against China, against Russia, against Vietnam, against Pyongyang, against any country who dares to defy U.S. unipolarity.
Mm-hmm. Keaton, let's have your opinion on the same question.
Well, I was always introduced to this topic through the analogy that when someone pulls a gun, when someone has a firearm, the space to be is behind the person holding the gun, and I think that translates pretty well into immigration into the United States. When U.S. and NATO topple Gaddafi's Libya, thousands and thousands of Libyans flee to the United States, flee to France, flee to the West, because, quite frankly, the U.S. is the only country that the U.S. cannot orchestrate a regime change in. And so it's trying to, people are trying to go to the safest place, which ultimately ends up being going to the aggressor, going to the oppressor historically and currently. And so the U.S.'s attempt to, as Danny said, that constantly pushing this aggression against China, who's attempting to build infrastructure and build hospitals and schools and put capital, put money to good use. The U.S. doesn't want that. And so any sort of pro-China, or more specifically, any sort of anti-American government is going to be an enemy of the U.S. State Department, of the intelligence agencies, and in turn, have got to go. It's got to be destroyed. It doesn't matter the cost of human lives. Iraq, Saddam had to go, no matter the cost. And so it's a historical thing. It's not even a phenomenon at this point. It is just a consistent foreign policy of the U.S. to take out anybody they don't like, no matter what the cost is.
Right. Daniel, I got one last question for you, and I want Keaton also to comment on that. And that's if you can think of any solution to this migrant problem in the United States.
Well, we can definitely think of a solution. That solution is called socialism. That solution is called reparations. That solution is called fight back, the unity of all oppressed people. Until there's a people's government here from D.C. to Miami to Los Angeles, nothing's going to change. This system, capitalism, is based on the pillaging of people's resources across the world. That's why they've gone after Syria so savagely. Look at these cruel sanctions imposed upon Tehran and upon Caracas and Havana, and now you have further aggression against Nicaragua. And I think it's time for the American people to connect the dots that who is the aggression meted out against? Any system that does not conform with U.S. hegemony, immediately they are under the boot and under the gun of U.S. militarism.
Okay, Keaton, what's the solution to the immigrant problem?
I absolutely think there is a solution. And I, of course, am a political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation. And we have proposed the policy solution, which is the San Dino-Zapata Economic Corridor. The United States, China, and Russia should partner together. They should invest the money that currently goes into arms manufacturing and maintaining nuclear weapons. Take that money and invest it into a sort of Central and South American Belt and Road Initiative. Build infrastructure. Build factories. Build schools and build hospitals in cooperation with the government of Central America. And then after these things are built, turn them over, turn the management and the ownership of these roads and schools and public facilities completely over to the government of that country. Make it viable for people to stay in their homeland. Make it economically viable for people in Central and South America to remain in their homeland, remain where their families have been for generations, and live a very, very good and robust life without having to be concerned about where food's coming from. Is, you know, is the U.S. going to kill our president tomorrow? That's the solution.
Okay. Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We have Professor at the City University of New York, Danish Shah, in New York, and author and political analyst for the Center for Political Innovation, Keaton Mansfield, also in New York. And I've been your host, Behruz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Holy Defense, a Mirror of Ashura. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. The Holy Defense Week has arrived again. This week starts on September 22nd, marking the beginning of invasion and occupation of Iran's soil by the Iraqi army under the former Iraqi ruler, Saddam Hussein, an imposition of the eight-year war. The holy defense of the Iranian nation against the invading army of Saddam was a manifestation of the eternal epic of Ashura and the unmatched uprising of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Stay tuned, please, for the first episode of a special series on the issue. The eight-year war that Saddam imposed on Iran at the behest of his masters in Washington in 1980s is known as the Holy Defense in Iran, Although war is a reminder of destruction and death, it becomes sacred and beautiful when it becomes an arena for manifestation of lofty human values. The eight-year holy defense against the Ba'athist army is such a war. The youth, men and women, who sacrifice their lives in this way are the examples of resistance and steadfastness whose memory will never be forgotten. The eight-year war began on September 22, 1980, with the full support and help of the West and the East, but the two blocks of power didn't achieve their wishes of disintegrating Iran and destroying the Islamic Republic system. This war turned into a strong point and honor for the Islamic Revolution and the point of growth and flourishing for Iran. More than 250,000 of its best Iranian youth were martyred, and tens of thousands of others became invalid in the war. The Iranian people proved that they had taken the example of Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura to stand firmly on their beliefs and values against the invasion of the global arrogance through its stooge Saddam. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had said earlier, "The Islamic Revolution of Iran is a gleam of Ashura and its great divine revolution." Ayatollah Khamenei says on the day of Ashura, "Look how much blessing this half a day has had in our history, and it has been alive and inspiring till this day. It is not just to be read and retell to enjoy people or impress them. It is rather the source of blessings and movement. This has been tangible in the revolution, the war, and our past history. In the history of Shiism, and rather the history of the anti-oppression revolutions in Islam, even by non-Shias, the event of Karbala has been brightly and conspicuously impressive. Perhaps it has been impressive in non-Islamic environments. In our own history, that is, the past 1,300 or 1,400 years, the very half-a-day event has been effective. Thus, it is nor strange and far-fetched. If we don't want to compare our eight-year war with that 8 to 9 hours of Imam Hussein's Ashura, or not consider it brighter than that, which this is the reality, I mean, I don't know any event in history which can be compared with that half a day. Everything is smaller than that, but this war is a scheme of that, or a drop of that sea, after all." Dear listeners, the lessons of Ashura have always been enlivening, moving, and inspiring. Although this event took place in a special place and time, its lessons are not limited to a certain time and place. Seeking of justice and freedom, struggle against oppression, tyranny and corruption are the outstanding lessons of Ashura. The first step in Imam Hussein's struggle is fearlessness. Superiority in number and military equipment should not cause fear, as this was fully manifested by Imam Hussein and his companions. Imam Hussein never feared the enemy's awe. The Iranian combatants during the eight-year holy defense too rushed to help the Hussein of the time, Imam Khomeini, without fearing the awe and propaganda of the enemy. They marched in the footsteps of Imam Hussein and his loyal companions with full trust in God. The Iranian combatants never capitulated to the calls of submission and preferred dignified death to life in humility. The young Iranian combatants knew it well that what could make them victorious over the enemy was their faith and trust in God and a steadfastness and unity among themselves. Martyr Mustafa Chamran beautifully depicts this in his supplication with Imam Hussein, peace upon him, when he says, "My master, I have come to fight with you against unfaith and oppression. I have come with all my being. It is Tasua, or 9th of Muharram. A huge group of Yazid's hordes are moving with a lot of tanks, cannons, armored vehicles, and many soldiers. Right and wrong have faced each other. The enemy is advancing rapidly, and I want to fight like one of your companions in Karbala." Iraq had dispatched 9 divisions to the war against Iran, and in practice, it enjoyed 12 armored, mechanized, and infantry divisions and 30 independent infantry brigades. Iraq's combat power was 8 times more than Iran. Yet, some estimates believe that it was 15 times stronger than Iran. What Saddam had never expected was the valor of Iran's combatants, who were scared of nothing and followed Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The Iranian combatants were the symbols of this part of Ayah 249 of Surah Baqarah, which reads, "How many small party has overcome a larger party by Allah's will? And Allah is with the patient."